Hi, I'm David Manti, and welcome to a new episode of the Today in Manufacturing podcast. With me this week are Jeff Ranke and Anna Wells. We each have more than 15 years of experience covering the manufacturing industry. Every week, we take the five most popular stories on the websites and discuss the implications they have on the industry going forward. But before we get started, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You can also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Jeff, David, or Anna at IN.com with email, the podcast, in the subject line. We are also live every Thursday at 2 p.m. on YouTube. So subscribe to at IN Magazine and join us every time we go live. Anna, how are you doing this week?
Doing fine. How are you?
I am doing excellent. You know, there was the near miss with the coffee cup, and I thought I like shattered a front tooth moments before we got on here.
Yes,
but other than that, everything fine.
Seconds, actually.
Yeah, it was loud. I'm just like, okay, we're good.
Grills intact. Still there. Yeah.
Yep. Jeff, how are you doing this week?
Good. I hope you don't have any more dental issues. You have not had good luck in that department, so careful when you're taking a drink.
I have a lifetime of dental issues ahead of me. My favorite was, I don't know, it was maybe 10 years ago now, when the dentist was just like, you have the teeth of an 85-year-old woman. And I was just like, that is oddly specific.
Yeah.
And then they guessed that I was raised on well water, and they're just like, hey, do the best you can.
Were you raised on well water?
Yes. And I had no idea how important fluoride was, depending on where you land on that whole conspiracy theory, but quite important, quite.
Conspiracy theory.
Oh, it's a deep one. We don't need to go on
Fluoride is?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I feel like fluoride's one of the original conspiracy theories. Like, it was either fluoride or the fake moon landing. I feel like those were, like, two of the first mainstream ones.
Or 401ks, right?
Whoa,
am I right, buddy?
Let's not get us started. Like, it's 401k and then JFK. All right. Before we get started with our first story this week, we have a word from our sponsor. This week's episode is brought to you by Ovacy MDT. The Secrets of OT Data Management is an exclusive new video podcast for manufacturers looking to stay ahead of the curve in today's digital landscape. Join Ovacy MDT's Dave McGovern and Jim Englehart, along with our Jeff Ranke, as they unveil the secrets of data management for manufacturers. Learn effective OT data management, control, cybersecurity, implementation, shortcuts, and more. Watch it now. All right. Our first story this week. Did I totally just blitz through the video?
We still got it. It's cute if you want to.
Yeah, let's play it. You know what? I'm sorry. I blitzed through the read and just completely didn't do the ad. So let's do that then.
My name is Jeff Ranke. I'm the editorial director for Manufacturing.net, Industrial Equipment News, and Manufacturing Business Technology. I'll be joined by Dave McGovern and James Englehart from Ovacy MDT to discuss various topics and provide takeaways on how you can be more efficient in the areas of OT data management control, version control, vulnerability protection, and much more. It's my pleasure to introduce Dave and Jim. Dave McGowan has 10 years of experience providing automation, change management, and disaster recovery solutions. He manages some of Ovacy MDT's largest enterprise accounts and is especially passionate about helping customers implement the best OT backup and cybersecurity strategies. Jim Englehart has been working in the controls world for 35 years. He has a BS in both chemical engineering and electrical engineering and has worked in the refining and chemical, engineering consulting, and food and beverage areas before settling in as head of pre-sales engineering, professional services, and support for the Americas at Ovacy MDT. He's also a member of the Ovacy MDT product team.
And we're back. Hope you enjoyed that video. I always knew it was there, and yet somehow I still forgot. Our first story this week. EV startup gets cash infusion following bankruptcy scare. EV startup Polestar was recently flirting with bankruptcy. Last November, Polestar was looking at a $1.3 billion shortfall when Geely Holding and Volvo Cars stepped up to fill the gap and keep the company above water until 2025. Until that time, or during this time, Polestar hoped to get the Polestar 3 and 4 crossover models with higher margins out the door. But last week, Volvo stopped funding the unprofitable EV maker and shifted focus to in-house battery technology. Polestar has since failed to ramp production, and EV demand has started to cool. Without a net, Polestar was looking for another cash infusion last week, and about a dozen lenders gave the automaker another $950 million in loans. This is according to Fortune. The loan went through only after Geely committed to supporting the cash-starved subsidiary. Despite the infusion, Polestar is still some $350 million short, and the company will likely have to restructure to make up the difference. As of Friday, the company was worth less than $3 billion. Jeff, that is quite the fall from the $20 billion it was worth when it was first listed on the market.
A little bit. It's kind of interesting. You know, I think Polestar, the goals are to always make it sort of the European version of Tesla is what they were shooting for there. And you can take a look by the vehicles that they've put out. All reports are they look cool, because they do, without a doubt. And they do drive well. They're good vehicles. There isn't a quality concern there. I think it's some of the factors you've talked about there in terms of EVs cooling a little bit. But I also think we're sort of rushing this a little bit when you look in comparison to other EVs. I understand that this came from Volvo and they had more. The funding was different than when Tesla started. But let's remember, it took Tesla 18 years to turn a profit.
Yeah.
And during that course of that time, and I understand the financials were a little bit more unique, but they lost billions of dollars before they got to where they are now, which is an $80 billion company making like $12 billion in profits. So it's going to take some time. And I think the fact that there is a little bit of that recent history at play here, I think that's why this, I think it was 12 different banks stepped up to provide the funding for them here. I think when you see Geely involved, that's really interesting because the US and China are Tesla's two biggest markets. So when you see a Chinese-based manufacturer looking to get involved with a European-based EV maker, you can connect the dots pretty quickly there and see kind of what's going on and what they're trying to do there from a market perspective in terms of where they may be looking to grow and where they see potential for Polestar. Because right now, although it's lagging in the US, it's got a solid market presence in Europe or in the EU. So there are some things to look at there. It feels like Volvo may have been a little bit early, in my opinion. Even though it's a ton of money that we're looking at here, I think they started pulling the plug a little bit sooner than they maybe should have.
Yeah.
But maybe they knew some of these other things were also going to come into play. So you can work with somebody else's money. Why mess with your own as well? So a lot of different factors here. We have not heard the last of Polestar. I still think there's still – obviously, they've got a bunch more funding here that they can use to leverage going forward. What's going to be interesting is if they can actually scale up the way they want to.
Yeah.
To hit 150,000 vehicles next year or by 2025, what they're looking for there, that's more than doubling production or more than doubling output from what they did in 2023 and even into 2024. So can they do that? Will the sales follow? It is a roll of a dice, but there is something to – when you look at the Tesla timeline a little bit, you can see some reasons for optimism.
Well, and just – the basic description, Swedish Tesla, like I'm already half in, you know, because it's just like, all right, so it's going to be cool and it's going to be high quality. And I also understand why Volvo kind of, I mean, bailed a little bit to bring everything in-house and focus on their own in-house battery technology. Just because, I mean, that makes sense. Like if you have the funds and you have the capability to do it in-house, maybe you want total control rather than relying on third parties. I don't know. Just a thought. Anna, it seems it's odd because I feel like we have covered the entire trajectory, like rise and falls of the EV industry kind of since we started the podcast, right? Because it took a dip and then all of a sudden it came like it was a really riding high and we were kind of surprised with how quickly we're like, oh no, the EV thing's happening now.
Yeah.
And now we're seeing another low where it feels like a lot of people are pulling back and it seems like Polestar might think that that might be the wrong decision for some automakers.
Yeah, and I think it's got to be subjective. You know, Polestar is a unique case. I think, you know, your points about Volvo wanting to bring some of the battery tech in-house and work on that, like, I think those are well articulated points because Volvo's objectives in the market have changed significantly since this got off the ground. I mean, they're one of the automakers that's already committed to becoming fully electric, and that's soon, like end of decade. So they are not maybe in need of this at this point in time. And so it's not necessarily a lack of support or a lack of, you know, they're not like losing hope in this brand. It's just that they have other fish to fry.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing that's interesting about Polestar, I think, is that despite the slumping e-market, I know you're going to speak to this a little bit too, David, but their CEO is kind of digging in his heels and, you know, despite these challenges that the company is facing, saying things like, I don't think that other companies should be pulling back on EVs. I think they're missing an opportunity. Mm-hmm. And in this crowded market, you can kind of see why there might be one or two of them that are going to try to actually double down, take advantage of the fact that some other companies are pulling back. Polestar has some advantages in the market. You know, Jeff mentioned the quality of their vehicles that they're putting out. They're building these vehicles in China. They're selling them in Europe. They have good brand value. We know that. And they have some really high margin vehicles. All of this will benefit them very well at scale. So if, you know, it's frustrating when you see them get so close to getting there. And that's when the financial problems start to start. And that happens to a lot of car companies. Yeah. So, you know, I'm hopeful that it will work out for them. I know that their CEO also pointed out some recent challenges in the EV market that he sees as being most paramount. And for him, he said that the biggest problem facing EVs is actually consumer sentiment, basically a fear of change that he says is consumer level. Mm-hmm. They don't want to, he called it not a good recipe for the future, mm-hmm. which is fair, I guess. But as Inside EVs pointed out, blaming consumers is sort of a cop-out when you consider that data has consistently pointed out over and over and over again that the biggest barriers are price, mm-hmm. range anxiety, and infrastructure. So to me, like a comment like that made me scratch my head a little bit to be like, is this chief really evaluating the market for what it is?
Yeah.
That was concerning to me to hear him say that consumers are just scared of EVs. I don't know if that's accurate. Mm-hmm.
No, I agree with you. Like the peace of mind is on the car maker. It's also on local infrastructure, but I mean, that's on him.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, like, when Reid kind of read a lot of the same material. And to me, it seemed like the CEO, Thomas Ingenlath, or Ingenlath, I thought at first he would came out really strong, right? Like he was saying like EV makers are making a mistake. Like they're all backing off right now when now is when you innovate. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we hear that all the time, right? Like what sets companies apart from their competitors is when there is kind of a downturn, the ones that innovate through it are the ones that kind of come out ahead. And I was like, yeah, you are right. Like stick with it, double down, and maybe you'll come out ahead of everybody else. But then, yeah, he kind of like turned and said like, and anyways, it's on the consumer. It's their fault for not being ready for it. You know, like they're just not ready to make the switch. And I don't know, when I read that, I was just like, hey, it's not on me. Like I'm very open-minded to an EV, but it's like a couple of very simple things that you just need to like two boxes you need to check, like you said, like range anxiety. And the one for me, I think, would be the availability of appropriate or adequate charging in my house. Mm-hmm. Like that's the one that is kind of like raised to the top as I've seen other people get, particularly that F1, the Lightning, and then other cars. And just they weren't able to get an adequate power source at their house to charge it to get back and forth from work. And so, I was just like, yeah, no, this Polestar guy, he knows what he's doing. And then I'm like, whoa, hang on a minute. But I think Polestar could benefit from this pause by other EV makers. I think that they could wind up coming out ahead.
I mean, somebody could if they want to try to exploit that gap, I guess. By the way, I love how high your voice gets when you say, I'm very open-minded.
It just proves how open-minded I am. Like.
There it goes again.
It is.
You're doing
it's
it.
Because yeah. It is because I'm so calm, cool, collected, and open-minded that I get it that high. And despite so many efforts, I have no control over it whatsoever. It's all right. It's personal failing. Okay. One thing I wanted to ask you guys, too, about Polestar is I remember the first time Polestar came out, and I'll start with you, Jeff. Like, out of the gate, I did not think Polestar would even make it this far. Do you think how far they made it so far is an achievement?
Yeah, I don't think I was surprised just because they had all the design engineering sort of under wraps. They felt very confident there. And due to the fact that they had a strong parent company, you could see how this could scale up and be successful. So I was confident there. But when you go back to 2017, the automotive landscape was so different.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
so exactly. Unique. So you could be optimistic because you've been hearing the OEs, other OEs talking about electric vehicles forever. You had Tesla that was really pushing the envelope there. So it made sense to me just from a geographical perspective, like Anna alluded to, you've got a company, Swedish company, European company, Chinese sourcing, manufacturing, all of that. So it made a lot of sense there. You know, going back to some of the comments about peace of mind and where that falls, I think it's kind of saying the same thing. When you talk about some of the things that are hindering consumers from getting there, it's all those things.
Yeah.
So it's all wrapped up together. Peace of mind is it's got to be a total package here. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It felt like he was saying the same thing two different ways to me.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Well, I guess. I mean, but like fear of change and like fear of change is different from vehicle prices are too high. You know, I'm not like afraid to buy a really expensive car. I'm just not going to do it.
Yeah.
Like there are things about scale that need to take place in order to like make it a more viable option for a lot of consumers. I don't think that's just like, I'm afraid to get behind the wheel because I don't know what to do. Like that's like what it made it sound like to me, that he was like, consumers just don't get it. And they're, mm-hmm. I don't know. I didn't think it was a fair assessment, but just me.
No. Yeah. I think it was kind of twofold, blaming the EV makers for like kind of throttling back a little bit when they should be pushing forward. And then, you know, kind of blaming that on, you know, inaction from consumers.
It does go hand in hand, I guess. You know, I don't want to split hairs here.
Let's split them.
When you're talking about consumer sentiment, I mean, pricing is going to be part of how they feel about stuff.
Yes.
And you know, availability and vehicle range and all that kind of stuff, it all bleeds together for me. I also don't blame the OEs for saying people aren't buying as many. I'm not going to make as many.
Yeah.
Like that's also fair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a mixed bag of stuff. So.
True. Well, and it's maybe if they kind of keep the innovation going in the background without making so many cars, because you're right, like cars that nobody's buying on a lot is good for nobody. Anna, were you surprised that Polestar has made it this long?
No, because I think because of the backing of Volvo always was like to me an injection of confidence. It's a really strong brand, and they if they have faith in what they're doing there, it made sense to me, I guess. But
okay. Just curious. Mm-hmm. Just curious. Our next most popular story. Large pork producer faces shocking worker retaliation allegations. Tosh Pork is the largest pork producer in Tennessee. According to a report from Genesis and SwineWeb, Tosh Pork had 38,000 sows in 2022, making it the 25th largest pork producer in the United States. This week, the company is facing some shocking allegations as part of a complaint from the U.S. Department of Labor. The Labor Department recently filed a motion for a temporary restraining order to prevent Tosh from retaliating against two workers who asked about their wages. Based in Henry, Tennessee, the company uses the H-2A Agricultural Guest Worker Program to employ people from foreign countries to work the farm. The company's products are typically sold to companies like JBS USA, Kroger, and Costco. The Labor Department's Wage and Hour Division found that a pair of Tosh Pork workers cooperated with investigators after asking about their pay. After the company learned of the complaint, the employer tasked one employee with jobs outside of their regular duties, like cleaning offices and bathrooms, and even picking up pig waste. Tosh Pork also tried to force the workers to sign a document forbidding them from speaking with other employees about pay issues. Well, during this investigation, officials also uncovered another story from a worker who was allegedly called in to meet with the farm's management, who then threatened their job after asking about wages. When the worker returned to their workstation, they found a severed pig's head. The Labor Department says the employer owes five workers a little more than $39,000 in back wages and assessed about $37,000 in civil money penalties. Now, Anna, when I say shocking allegations, that is pretty salacious. And if there's any validity to that, I don't even know where to start in terms of what you need to do to fix what's broken at Tosh Pork.
Yeah, this story was incredibly gross on multiple levels. And to me, the H-2A guest worker program is sort of at the crux of this. So as you said, Tosh Pork employs people from foreign countries to work on its farm through this program. Mm-hmm. And so while everyone else in the food manufacturing industry or other verticals within manufacturing are like bending over backwards to recruit and retain people, these clowns are taking advantage of this program. Nothing wrong with it on its surface, but in turn, perhaps using the limited resources and funds available to the people who are working there to exploit them. Because to me, you can't tell me that putting a severed pig's head at a workstation of someone is being done if you think that that person has other options or would be compelled to go to the authorities or to go to the media. Mm-hmm. Because it's so outrageous. This stuff about like coercing people to sign documents that don't make any sense and aren't legal. Like, you are leveraging the fact that people are afraid.
Yeah.
Maybe they don't know what their rights are. Mm-hmm. And you can clearly tell that this was part of the problem. Just by the way, the Department of Labor closed their press release when they issued a release about this incident. Mm-hmm. The final words in that document were, the Wage and Hour Division offers confidential compliance assistance to anyone, regardless of where they are from, with questions about how to comply with the law by calling the agency's toll-free helpline. The division can speak with callers in more than 200 languages. They know this is a problem specific to foreign workers who I think can be uniquely vulnerable in a situation like this. And this is an illustration of that. So to that end, it seems like a reasonable expectation that these companies that are using programs like the H-2A be subject to a greater level of scrutiny because it's so easy to take advantage of these folks. And obviously, you're glad that they got caught, but to see this kind of stuff taking place, you know that this is a cultural systematic problem that's probably taken place at a plant like this for many years.
Oh, yeah. And just been excused for many years. See, part of the problem with me, though, is, you know, OSHA has the resources to speak to these people in 200 different languages. But how, I mean, A, we can't expect a company like Tosh Pork to go hanging signs in 200 different languages to help their workers, especially when their idea of...
Yes, we can.
Well, okay. Well, I mean, we can ask them to, but like, I mean, when you look at... Are you talking about just in terms of enforcement, making sure they're hung and stuff like that?
I'm saying it's not unreasonable to say if you've got someone who speaks a foreign... If you're going to use this program in which you are deliberately and intentionally going outside of the U.S. to find employees... Yes, the expectation should then be you're going to have an effective way to communicate with these individuals.
So I agree with that. I'm just saying that a company with this sort of culture that is taking advantage of these workers is not going to do that. It's basically going to not do that until they get caught.
Okay.
So I don't, Jeff, part of this comes from failures to pay overtime or just flat out refusal because the workers were asking about overtime and that's when things got dicey. You know, some of that goes back to the problem where, like, these are vulnerable workers that maybe they just know they have a history of taking advantage of and they know they can get away with a lot of stuff.
Well, the one thing I just want to say, because we, correct me if I'm wrong, we don't know for sure which classification of employee filed these, do we?
We do not. But I think that it's easy to read between the lines of the Department of Labor's press release the fact that they mention this program. And the fact that they mention that they are available to field complaints from anyone, no matter where they're from.
Okay. The only reason I bring that up is we're looking at a town. This town is 500 people and they employ 300 at their facility. Mm-hmm. So when you're looking again to Anna's point about lack of opportunities potentially there, the mistreatment may not have been relegated strictly to those who are on this visa program. This could have been a situation where they were also bringing folks in for a seasonal employment. Treating them a certain way, but then sort of dogging out the people that were going to be there the whole year round. Not saying that's what happened. I'm saying there's a lot of different things that could have been happening at a facility like this because it's 200 miles or excuse me, about 2 hours west of Nashville. It is in an isolated, probably very heavily agricultural area. When you look around this town, not a lot going on. Okay. Yeah. Not a lot of larger cities and maybe not a lot of opportunities. So the other thing I think that can be overlooked in when you're used to operating in that type of geography, and I can testify to that because I come from a town of 1,000 people that's very agricultural based, you may not realize the transparency that you're bringing with you when you go with one of these visa programs. Everything is wide open. If you read the documentation behind this H-2A.
H-2A.
H-2A. It says basically in there about how you're going to pay these folks, You have to be very open on what they're going to make so that everybody knows that. Not only the individuals coming in on the visa, but the individuals working there as well. So everything is transparent. Everybody knows what everybody's getting offered, at least initially. For someone to ask a question about what they're getting paid should be a pretty normal thing.
Yeah.
That shouldn't be something. And as soon as you try to get people to sign documents saying, I'm not going to ask for that, well, that's just going to raise
about it.
That's going to raise everybody's awareness of the issue and make it and just propagate it into heightened levels that you're trying to avoid potentially. And when the clear answer is just be transparent or just have a policy that says, you know what, we talk with individuals, but we don't give out public information or however you want to portray it.
Okay. Yeah.
But you can put something in place where it's not essentially bullying people into just taking what they're getting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what it seems like. There is a very hockey stick escalation when it comes to people questioning authority there, where it's just like, no. Instead of me answering your questions, sign this document that says you're not going to ask us anymore. And then sign this document that says you're not going to talk about it to anybody else anymore. And you know what? Here's a pig's head. Like, that is wild, man.
It feels like kind of a little big town culture is what it feels like to me. You've got a big company operating in a small town where they've always used to been doing things a certain way. But then when you open yourself up to these other programs, you open yourself up to greater scrutiny. In this case, it may have been beneficial to a lot of different employees.
Yeah.
I'm sure the culture there is terrible, right? I mean, if this is taking place, then you would think that everyone would be impacted by it.
Yeah. Well, and we talk about issues that the food manufacturing, particularly the meat processing part of the food manufacturing industry, what they face on a day-to-day basis. And this just sets them back because it seems like something that would have happened 50 years ago, not like now.
Right.
Tosh Pork's veterinarian, Seth Krantz, actually responded to a comment or issued a comment to CBS Money Watch saying, quote, "It is important to Tosh Pork that our employees are treated with dignity and respect and that our animals receive proper care." The animals receiving proper care, that was a surprise that they put into that statement. I was just like, oh no, more's coming. Mm-hmm. Tosh Pork seeks to follow all federal, state, and local regulations, including the Fair Labor Standards Act. Well, they may seek to do that. They are falling down. I would like to add that these are all allegations. Krantz did say in the statement that the company denies all of these allegations and plans to defend itself in court. And man, they better bring something with them because it is a tall order based on the allegations that they're facing.
Yeah.
Like, we haven't seen anything like that in a long time. Like, that wasn't in a movie, you know? Just wild to me. All right, our next most popular story. Bridge collapsed after repeated maintenance recommendations. In the early morning on January 28th, 2022, a bus and four passenger vehicles were crossing the Fern Hollow Bridge in Pittsburgh. The bridge experienced a structural failure and fell some 100 feet into the park below. Multiple people were injured, some serious, and a fifth car that wasn't on the bridge when it collapsed actually drove off the bridge and landed upside down in the park. According to a recent NTSB report, the bridge failed despite repeated maintenance and repair recommendations following several inspections. Investigators say the collapse started when the transverse tie plate on the southwest bridge leg failed due to extensive corrosion and section loss. Some of these critical components had visible holes after nearly a decade and extensive thinning. The corrosion and material loss were created by clogged drains that caused water and road salts to run down bridge legs and accumulate along with debris at the bottom of the legs. This all prevented a protective rust layer from developing. As a stopgap, steel cables were added as a temporary measure in 2009 until a rigid cross bracing could be replaced. But this project was never completed. The city was also supposed to add a rust inhibiting coating, but that was never applied. According to the NTSB, the probable cause of the Fern Hollow Bridge's failure was structural, but also the city's failure to act on repeated maintenance and repair recommendations from inspection reports. The NTSB also took a shot at the poor quality of these inspections, and the NTSB essentially blamed the entire the entire city of Pittsburgh. Anna, it was wild because the two cameras on the bus pretty much caught everything, and you got to kind of see it happen in real time, and it is incredible that nobody lost their life.
Yeah, the footage is going to give me nightmares. So thank you for that.
Yeah.
You know, the corrosion was described in the report as extensive. And I'm interested to know how long it takes to get to that point of extensive corrosion. The bridge was being inspected every other year up until 2014 when they started doing that inspection yearly. That's according to the NTSB. And yet nothing had been done. Mm-hmm. And I think there are some obvious problems of that. But, you know, users are unknowingly putting their lives at risk every time they get on that bridge, which is really indefensible. But two, like, what is the point of these inspections?
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, like how are we dealing with these agencies that are issuing reports detailing potentially catastrophic failures that are impending? And the city still has the ability to completely ignore that. Because, you know, outside of the obvious, which is a safety risk, which is unbelievable. But also, why are we wasting the precious time and resources of these agencies? You know, it's like, I think they need to be on the hook for not just the collapse, but the inspections and warnings that go unheeded. Because some of these photos of the corrosion are absolutely horrible. And you wonder how the municipality can keep defending, keeping that bridge operational while they knew that was taking place. And if you look at the report, NTSB board member Michael Graham said, the bridge didn't collapse just by an act of God. It collapsed because of lack of maintenance and repair. And as you said, they blame the city for this, and they should have. Mm-hmm. And yet, because the NTSB can investigate these transportation disasters, but they have no ability to enforce, you know, or compel anyone to address these issues based on their reports, then the government agencies really don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
So what is the recourse? You know, they're calling it a serious wake up call for the Penn DOT. Like, that's not good enough for me.
Yeah.
That's like, I'm glad you learned your lesson at the expense of all these people who very, very easily could have lost their lives, to your point. And they're not really being penalized here. And to me, that's just, that's indefensible.
Well, it's not just a serious wake up call to Pennsylvania, but I'll get into it in a bit, but it's a serious wake up call to pretty much anyone that has a bridge made with this steel. Jeff, when people have issued statements about what happened in Pittsburgh here, I heard phrases like cascade of failures and nobody looks good. You know, Anna kind of brought it up as about the inspectors. To me, that was just the inspectors being like, okay, we got to go and see that it's still bad. Mostly because, like, they don't want the blame to fall on them. They can at least go to these reports and say, like, hey, we've been telling them for years that this is bad. But I mean, also to that point, like, they need a little bit more teeth that, okay, if the city doesn't do anything, they can either shut it down, kind of like we see in manufacturing, where if there are, you know, historical bad actors where you can actually shut a manufacturer down, mm-hmm. Or do something else just to kind of keep people out of harm's way.
Yeah, what caught me is, you read the video, you read the script for there, you wrote the script for this one?
Yeah.
For the video. How many times did you say, supposed to?
Oh, yeah.
They were supposed to do this.
And
this
I was supposed to happen. Down. Yeah.
That's what caught me in looking at this story. Also, when you do a little bit more digging, this spanned four different administrations for the city of Pittsburgh. So yeah. It wasn't like it was a new thing. I mean, yeah. You already alluded to it. This has been around for a decade.
Yeah.
I don't know how you make people be better at their jobs. First of all, the NTSB, in my opinion, according to whatever they did, I would disagree. I don't think they're doing these inspections just to sort of a check the box type of thing. I do think that these folks are sincere in what they do. There's no way you can go do those reports that you like looking at so much. And
oh,
the
yeah.
amount of – and I would even call them, in a positive way, there's a lot of bias in those reports.
Yeah.
The way that they write them, they do not mince words. They come right out with who they feel is at fault and what was done incorrectly. And in this case, they identify the engineering flaw. Mm-hmm. Very early on, in terms of the way the water was collecting, the way the rust preventative coatings that they were trying to use were not allowed basically to take play or to be used or be utilized or put into play because there was another engineering flaw, which you'll probably get into. The only thing that I can even think of here is unless you put some sort of like branch of the U.S. Marshals into the NTSB to start holding them accountable in some way, shape, or form, is when these inspectors go out and you reach a certain point, you just start posting this stuff on social media.
That's my thought. Yeah.
Here is the NTSB. Here's our report. We told them what to do.
Yep.
Yeah.
You guys, you know, lean on your government in order to make it happen.
Yeah.
And let's not forget, it was only like 2.5 years ago that the federal government gave out like $1.2 trillion for infrastructure improvement.
Yeah.
I think this is what it was meant for.
No, completely agree. And it's, Doug, hi. It's always good to see you, Doug. No, to that point, this is a much greater issue too. And I don't think it's the NTSB comes in after the fact, right? So I think the NTSB is calling out all the local inspectors that work for the cities and the counties and are flagging these problems and them not being able to do anything else other than like, but I mean, you're right. Those reports, I mean, while they are probably a part of like public record, like maybe those inspectors got to do a little bit more to like get it out there.
Yeah, if they can't do anything to compel the DOT to act on their findings, if they reach a point where this is a dangerous situation, I agree. Issue a press release. Like, give them the power to do that at a minimum. So people know what they're doing when they get on that bridge. How would anyone know how dangerous that was without any of that information being available?
Yeah, just a couple of photos like, hey, here's a selfie of me taken through the bridge's leg. All right, so this also renews concerns about what is known as unpainted steel. So according to a Scripps report, there have been ongoing problems with uncoated weathering steel for decades. Now, originally, the manufacturers said it would naturally resist corrosion without ever needing a paint job. So we can understand why this was, you know, attractive to local governments around the United States. Gary Tinkelberg is a corrosion expert. He even has a pamphlet that goes back to 1968 that claims the material could make bridges, quote, that paint themselves. Now, not painting bridges cut costs. It sped up construction timelines. It didn't require painting or repainting year after year. These were largely seen as like maintenance-free structures as a result. But as far back as the 1980s, this Tinkelberg guy performed tests that found that one particular case, de-icing salt, was preventing a crucial natural protective coating from forming, leaving weathering steel vulnerable to decay. Back in the 1980s, these problems are as old as me, and that is old. That is so old. These problems are so old, they're graying. So when Tinkelberg was asked about this and where we're at now, he says that he still sees a lot of ugly steel. Yeah. Like, that's a quote. Nationally, according to Scripps, 251 bridges are made of weathering steel and are currently rated in, quote, poor condition. So this is like, you know, you would hope that something like this, which happened in 2022, by the way, like would have really caused a little bit more of a groundswell to replace and repair these structures. And I mean, hopefully this report goes to maybe push it forward a little bit more. I don't know. It was just, it was crazy to me when I started reading this. I'm like, there's no way. Like, how does it go back to the 80s? Where he started seeing this as an issue, and it hasn't been repaired.
Mm-hmm.
Just saving cost, man.
It's interesting when they talk about that sort of natural patina that's supposed to occur here, and you think about your faucets and stuff like in the basement.
Yeah,
you think, well, it looks kind of cool, not realizing that actually adds to the structural integrity of that piece of metal.
No, we're taught to see rust as like structural decay and failure, whereas like when it's on your pipes, you know, it's good. But not if it's...
That's interesting with the self-painting type of approach to maintenance.
Yeah, no, it's... I mean, I get it. It's great. Just like, hey, maintenance free.
Yeah.
Unpainted steel. Lot of ugly steel out there still. It's no good. I should actually see if any of it is on my commute home.
Yeah, well, we do use de-icing salt around here, so that makes me a little nervous.
See what
you can find out about those 251 bridges.
Yeah, you know what? It was an interactive map, so maybe I'll spend a little bit more time on that Scripps page. All right, our next most popular story this week. Toyota practically giving away its hydrogen vehicles. According to Ward's Auto, Toyota recently issued a $40,000 sales incentive for the second generation Mirai. This normally sells for $52,000. The Mirai also includes $15,000 in complimentary fuel. So when you factor that in, it's kind of like Toyota is paying you $3,000 to drive a Mirai for 6 years. That's how long the free fuel package runs. I mean, there are some limitations. For example, the Mirai is only sold in California, and Toyota dealerships in the state are not exactly stocking the Mirai in large quantities. And then there's finding hydrogen fuel. The Toyota Mirai could be a great vehicle. 402 miles of range and the only emission is water. But given the limited infrastructure to support it, I mean, it just might be ahead of its time, Anna.
Yeah, and I think even the term limited infrastructure is a little bit charitable in what we're looking at here.
Yeah.
Of course, this is not a practical vehicle, considering the state of that infrastructure, right? So you have to wonder whether Toyota, in seeing that, just needed some people to roll the dice and get these out on the roads, whether that's for test and development, marketing, potentially both. And to be honest, you would probably have to be batting 1,000 to get good feedback on an experimental powertrain if the person driving it had to put up a lot of cash for it. That's just my opinion on that. Like when people buy vehicles, like the price point is such that they typically want a lot out of that deal, rightfully so. And they're not happy, I think, if Toyota is kind of working out the kinks at their expense. Just look at some of the early feedback on the Cybertruck. Anyway, I think it's also possible that outside of the hydrogen factor that this vehicle is just a dud, maybe. Because we've seen vehicles go down for much less. And if you look at what Kelley Blue Book reports are the reviews on this thing, users were quite divided on it. 45% gave the vehicle 5 stars and 45% gave it 1 star.
Whoa, no middle.
No middle, really. Where it got dinged most was value, probably not an issue now that it is free, but also performance and reliability, which are big ones, I think. But many of the buyers also blasted that infrastructure piece. And if refueling is even more challenging than what we have in place for electrics and people still cite this as a massive barrier, then it's going to be hard to get people to bite, right?
Yeah.
And in this case, like I said before, it's possible that Toyota is just kind of moving past attempts to recoup costs here and is viewing this as more part of the development cycle of just getting these out there, getting some feedback, tinkering with what they have.
It's a beta test.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, we've seen that before where it's kind of get it out there, get more people's hands on it and use that feedback to come up with the next generation.
Yeah.
I mean, talking about your Cybertruck jab. It's taking a page out of the Tesla book. Anna, would you take a chance on a free hydrogen car?
Well, I don't live in California.
If you could, in this hypothetical, it was California and Wisconsin.
But what's the hypothetical? Like, can I hypothetically have a hydrogen refueling station?
Like, yes, you can hypothetically have one.
Okay.
It's like mildly inconvenient. It's like 10 miles out of your way.
Yeah, I don't think so. I'm comfortable with where electrics are, because I know that there's a lot of them out there and a lot of the technology has been road tested for now multiple years.
Yeah.
Hydrogen, I'm not there yet.
Yeah.
And the infrastructure piece is, I'm sorry, you can't hypothetical that out of it. Yeah, it's just like, it's too much of a reality problem.
All right. Well, then, Jeff, I'm going to hypothetically place you in California.
Okay.
You move to California, start working remote. Everyone's cool with it. It's fine. We do this remote. I mean, it changes the dynamic a little bit, but it's still all right.
Okay.
Would you take a chance on a free hydrogen Toyota?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely.
Okay.
Without a doubt.
Without a doubt?
6 years, no gas, no fuel bill.
Where's your
free
fueling
car?
Station? Hypothetically, where's your fueling station?
Well, that's the thing that's interesting. When you look at $15,000 worth of hydrogen they're providing or first fuel, that's literally a ton.
Yeah.
I mean, using some fuzzy math. So as far as having that, yeah, just even storing that, forget about the actual refueling dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you put that? Like, how do you store that much of this fuel? So that is interesting. Another thing, you know, digging into this, there's like 17,000 of these hydrogen vehicles on the road, primarily in California. I was surprised at that. The fact that they even sold like 3,000 of them last year kind of blew me away. So it is interesting. I think that what surprised me about this is that it was Toyota coming out and making these dramatic cuts or really stepping away from a hydrogen vehicle because they've been the ones that have been very hesitant, sort of dipping their toes in the EV market. They're still really I think, connected to that hybrid model. That's really where they tend to lean towards. Mm-hmm. And they were putting money into hydrogen development. So it was interesting that they've stepped away this strongly, I guess. I could see them sort of, you know, step by step, you know, moving away from it. But to be that dramatic was surprising.
You got to make money, though. Like,
well, the other thing, I think there is opportunities to make money here, though. If you're looking at fleets and if you're looking even at some rideshare type of businesses, I do think there is an opportunity for hydrogen there if you wanted to partner up with somebody. Because it's what we've seen with hydrogen right now. It's been in like, you know, GM just did that thing where they sort of had that hub, if you will, where it was sort of an enclosed sort of like a city center type thing where it was all hydrogen based and fleet vehicles. We also saw that out in, where was that? I think that was out in California. Toyota was actually messing around with that out there. I think it was like near a port. They had some fleet vehicles, hydrogen refueling and all that stuff. So there are applications for it where I think it makes sense, especially fleets, especially if you have a huge campus. I think, you know, if you do have a need for vehicles just moving around in that sort of limited space, this could be kind of a boon for your business if you're basically getting all of those vehicles along with the power source for them for nothing.
Yeah.
I don't know. There could be somebody out there who's able to take advantage of this. It's a limited application. Yeah. I will 100% acknowledge that. Like I said, it just surprised me that it was Toyota. If it was a bigger, somebody else who had been more adamant about not going into EVs, it wouldn't have surprised me as much.
So in this hypothetical, you could either live in Los Angeles County, which has the most hydrogen refueling stations at 27, but that's 27 of the 55 total in all of California.
How far north can we get?
Yeah, what's this one? There's like one little green dot.
LA Jeff doesn't like this.
You can get to Truckee, California, which everyone knows. Beautiful
kind of population are we looking at there?
In Truckee, California, let me just run some quick numbers there.
I'd like to take this moment to apologize to our producers when I raise my voice. I can almost see their ears start on fire. So my apologies about that.
Only 17,000 people in Truckee.
I could handle that.
Yeah, you could live in Truckee.
You can live in Truckee.
I think so. It's kind of on the
eastern
part of the state there.
Just not a lot of commuting, you know, back and forth.
Could handle that.
No, I was kind of surprised to know that in like all of California, there were only like 55 hydrogen fueling stations. But what this story, and Jeff, you mentioned it a little bit. We ran a story this week about a new fuel cell related pilot project that's bringing a hydrogen based worksite ecosystem, an entire ecosystem, to a Georgia power plant. Right now, this is an application from GM. GM is collaborating on the project and is actually going to provide a fleet of fuel cell powered medium duty trucks, as well as the supporting infrastructure. The trucks are built on the similar frame to the 2024 Chevy Silverado, and they're going to be powered by the GM's Hydrotech fuel cell systems. The prototype trucks will have an estimated range greater than 300 miles per fill up, although there is that pretty little asterisk of range may vary. and they're going to have a 19,500-pound gross vehicle weight rating. Southern Company, which is one of the largest utility companies in the United States, plans to use the trucks as shop vehicles at its work sites. Like you said, ideal application. And Southern Company, together with GM and a Norwegian fuel cell company, Nel ASA, will also demonstrate an integrated hydrogen microgrid for fueling infrastructure, including a stationary fuel cell based mobile power generator. And I don't know, it made me think of like how, I don't know, sometimes it seems like hydrogen is so much farther away than EV, and then EV comes into like all kinds of problems. And I'm just like, I don't know, maybe they're both just as far behind. But I don't know. I see like there are real world applications where hydrogen can work. And, you know, with infrastructure, it could be a suitable alternative.
I think hydrogen has its place.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's at the consumer level.
I agree.
I really don't. Because you still have a lot of issues with just the production of it. Okay, we know how to make and distribute electricity.
Yeah.
We figured that out. And we can do that in a pretty environmentally conscious way, in a clean way, if you will. Hydrogen's still really messy. And it's still really difficult. And I think, again, there are applications for it where we can lower our reliance on the grid through the use of hydrogen plants. I just don't think it's at a consumer vehicle level.
Yeah, even in free cars.
Well, you see some of these Kelley Blue Book reviews, and this is people who paid for these vehicles, and they're like basically talking about how their vehicles are bricked, you know, because they can't. They're like,
well, try to get somebody to fix it.
That too, you know. And so, like, I agree that like a very insular application Maybe that works. But again, does it justify all of the development cost? Does it justify the impact of, you know, sourcing the fuel and getting this all set up? It's just, it's a lot of cost.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about this being a suitable application, and we're talking about the players being General Motors, one of the largest utility companies in the world, and a notable Norwegian fuel cell company. So, you know, you got a lot of
smart people working
on the problem versus, you know, just one person in their new hydrogen car trying to figure it out.
Oh, yeah, of course. But it's, again, it's not going to stop him from being expensive.
It is. Yeah. All right. Our most popular story this week. EV startup Fisker trying to pair with large automaker as money runs out. Last May, EV maker Fisker announced that the first customer had taken delivery of the brand new Fisker Ocean all-electric SUV with about 440 miles per charge. Fisker also claimed that the Ocean had the lowest carbon footprint of any SUV on the market. Since then, things have taken a turn, and for the worse for Fisker. In a recent financial announcement, Fisker outlined some dark prospects. Despite increasing its quarterly revenue, the car maker's gross margin is negative 35%. It's a minus 35%. The mounting losses have led CEO Henrik Fisker to call 2023, quote, a challenging year and reveal.
It's not my favorite.
A most challenging year and reveal more details of the company's plan to pivot from direct sales to a dealer network. Hopefully, in an effort to unload the inventory it's sitting on after producing about double the number of Oceans delivered. Fisker also unveiled that it was in negotiations with a, quote, large automaker as it looks for a lifeline and manufacturing help in North America. Hopefully these negotiations go quickly because the company is already in cost-cutting mode, laying off some 15% of its workforce. Fisker has cast substantial doubt on its, quote, ability to continue without an infusion of cash, saying it has insufficient resources to last for the next 12 months. So, Anna, should Fisker and its employees remain optimistic or prepare for another difficult year as well as an
challenging,
most uncertain future?
Yes, it will certainly be challenging. You know, we've learned a little bit more about the story since this one came out. The Automotive News is reporting that it's Nissan who is in talks with Fisker. Okay. So I don't know. That made me feel a little bit more optimistic just knowing that this was an actual thing and not just something you say. But, you know, like we talked about earlier, it's just it's that time in the cycle where Fisker's having cash flow problems, a very common occurrence around this time where they're trying to scale what they already have in place. They've done a ton of the work. It's hard to like let that go.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe there's some opportunity for another company to leverage some of those assets. So Fiskers have been well received by buyers up to now. They do have some cool advantages relating to the carbon footprint, as you said, the range. So for an automaker like Nissan to come to the rescue and invest to a rumored tune of, I think, $400 million, not only it addresses an existential threat for Fisker, but it also does some things for Nissan, I think. Reuters is reporting that Nissan likely has its eye on the Fisker Alaska, which is a compact pickup truck that's said to be Fisker's top priority right now.
Okay.
The $400 million injection would reportedly go straight into the Fisker truck platform, with Nissan planning to build the Alaska in one of its plants. It's got a couple in the U.S., I think, and one in Tennessee and another one in the South. Anyway, but then the plan would be for Nissan to also build its own EV pickup on the same platform. If you look at Nissan's EV lineup right now, the biggest thing that they offer right now is the Ariya. That's their newest.
That was the new Leaf, right? Is the Ariya?
No, I'd say it's more of a CUV.
Oh, yeah, okay. It would be like a small SUV or a CUV. My point is, it's not big, right? It's not as big as it gets for Nissan right now. I think if Nissan could add a pickup to the mix and leverage the battery range that Fisker already has, this technology that they're working with, then I think $400 million actually starts to sound like maybe a good deal for them, especially when you consider that the Alaska is reportedly in the $45,000 range to start, meaning that whatever Nissan throws together in kind would likely be well competitive with what is available, maybe even besting some of those prices of those EV trucks on the market. So they might have like a good little package there with this tie up, because, again, I think the investment amount, when you look at the grand scheme of the development costs, what these automakers are putting into their lines, especially to build like a new truck, I don't think it's a bad deal.
Well, I mean, yeah, what did Apple have into theirs? $10 billion.
And that's not the, that's apples to oranges. Sorry. Well,
thank you. Well, yes, it is. It's apples to Fiskars. No, but we talk about other troubled EV startups like not Rivian. What was the Endurance?
Well, that was Lordstown.
Lordstown. Mm-hmm. And we talk about possibly being able to sell the IP, but it was never really proven. One thing that Fisker has done reliably, and talking about Henrik Fisker, is that he's always made good cars. And so, like, for $400 million, you know it's probably going to work and be a good overall design versus, you know, other cars that were, you know, tested by pushing them down a hill. So, Jeff, what were your thoughts on Fisker's fate? I mean, I was going to get into it a little bit, but like, do you remember Fisker? Like, they kind of already died once and like kind of twice already.
Yeah, they've got an interesting story for sure. And we don't have to dive into that.
Well, I'm diving into it a minute.
Go for it, man. I think when you say challenging, when he describes his year as challenging, when you're losing negative 35% margin, that reminds me when people would ask me, what was it like raising three teenage daughters? And I would say, there's a lot of feelings. I think it was a dramatic understatement to call it a challenging year. I agree with Ann. I think this would be a great move for Fisker as well, because even though I'm not an authority on Fisker specifically, I've always felt they had a cool looking product, but they did not have an identity in any way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. When you have everything from the Pear, which is basically like a Kia or a Leaf or something like that, that they're going to try to sell for about $30,000, everything up to like their supercar Ronin for like $400,000.
Yeah.
What are you?
Yeah.
you're an EV maker, but what really are you? And if this partnership with Nissan gives them a little more focus and a little more direction in terms of developing the Alaska truck, and then I would think there's also probably going to be some parallels that would go along with the Ocean SUV that they really seem to really be championing and really getting behind, I think it could be a huge win for them. And not only the infusion of cash and manufacturing infrastructure, and also, as we've talked about more than once, it's hard to make a car, so it's good to partner with people who know how to do that and have been doing it for a little bit. Taking some of that organic expertise, applying it to your organization, and putting out what truly are differentiating vehicles in a very crowded marketplace. When you look at SUVs and trucks, a lot of new players there, but Fisker has a very unique look. They've just never had necessarily, like, in my opinion, an identity as an automaker. I think this could really help them with that, get them exposure. They're also looking at getting into a dealer type of network, which I think is a really good idea.
Yeah.
I think this whole thing of trying to skirt that dynamic, again, we talk about the consumer already not feeling good about the EV itself in terms of price and range and infrastructure. And then you say, well, you got to order it online.
Yeah.
And we got a garage you can take it to, but it's not really a dealership. That just throws another sort of wrench into that familiarity or comfort level dynamic.
Yeah.
So going that route, I think, is also a good move, and hopefully they pursue that as well. So I think there is a lot of positive things here for Fisker. Personally, I'm kind of rooting for them because they do put a lot of really cool engineering into their products.
No, I think Fisker does have an identity, but in my mind, it is with supercars. Because those are the ones I've seen on the road, and it's just, they always turn your head. It's few and far between, but you're just like, and then you see the Fisker badge and you're like, oh, okay. You know, it was, you know, Henrik Fisker is a man with a great pedigree. Like I said, the Fisker sort of brand already kind of died once, kind of twice, but looking at his legacy a little bit, he's been working on electric cars since the late 1980s. And he was working on an electric car since 1989 at BMW. He moved to Ford to work on Aston Martins. In 2005, he started a custom car company, Fisker Coach Build, which kind of fizzled in 2007. That's the first Fisker I'm talking about. at that time, he did initial design work on the Tesla Model S. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that led to a little bit of controversy and legal issues with Tesla. And as to whether or not how much the Model S might have inspired the Fisker Karma. Well, then he founded Fisker Automotive in 2007, which did last 6 years until bankruptcy in 2013. And, you know, he worked on other projects until relaunching as Fisker Inc. in 2016. So we're on the third Fisker. He's designed some really cool cars, but he kind of has a history of consistently being ahead of his time. The Ocean electric SUVs are really cool. One of the things that I like is that they have like interiors made from upcycled materials, like old t-shirts. And I think one of the cars even used like old nets from the ocean as like as a resource. But you're right. Like, I mean, did you talk about how the pair, remember like who was going to, who they were going to partner with to make the pair, mass manufacture that? Mm-mm. It was Foxconn. That was the, like, they were going to partner with Foxconn to make a cool and exotic car. And I'm just like, oh, it's a bad choice.
How many times does this need to happen?
Yeah. So when you hear like Fisker and Nissan, I'm just much more optimistic. Mm-hmm. Just like I hear Fisker and Foxconn and I'm like, run as fast as you can.
But you know, you mentioned those supercars, which they are amazing.
Yeah.
Okay? They're incredible. But as a car company, how do you have in your, now I'm just, this is your lineup. You've got four vehicles in your lineup.
Yeah.
How can you go from 30 to 300,000?
Yeah.
That just seems hard to manage to me. I don't know.
It is, but it's like, I think that's why they focused on the Ocean as being in the middle. And maybe they were focusing on the Pear too. And I haven't heard any development on that.
Next year.
Next year. Okay.
Because this one's going to be challenging. So they're going to wait until next year.
Yeah, no, it's next year's going to be great though.
Yeah.
Be a real winner. All right. Well, before we jump into, in case you missed it, we have another word from our sponsor, obviously MDT.
My name is Jeff Ranke. I'm the editorial director for Manufacturing.net, industrial equipment news, and manufacturing business technology. I'll be joined by Dave McGovern and James Englehart from obviously MDT to discuss various topics and provide takeaways on how you can be more efficient in the areas of OT data management control, version control, vulnerability protection, and much more. It's my pleasure to introduce Dave and Jim. Dave McGowan has 10 years of experience providing automation, change management, and disaster recovery solutions. He manages some of obviously MDT's largest enterprise accounts and is especially passionate about helping customers implement the best OT backup and cybersecurity strategies. Jim Englehart has been working in the controls world for 35 years. He has a BS in both chemical engineering and electrical engineering and has worked in the refining and chemical, engineering consulting, and food and beverage areas before settling in as head of pre-sales engineering, professional services, and support for the Americas at obviously MDT. He's also a member of the obviously MDT product team.
Hey, and we're back. And just look at how much easier that works when I let the commercial play. It's so much easier. So this week's episode brought to you by obviously MDT. The Secrets of OT Data Management is an exclusive new video podcast for manufacturers looking to stay ahead of the curve in today's digital landscape. Join obviously MDT's Dave McGovern and Jim Englehart, along with Jeff Ranke, as they unveil the secrets of data management for manufacturers. Learn effective OT data management control, cybersecurity, implementation, shortcuts, and more. Watch it now. All right, in case you missed it, stories maybe not as popular on the website, but still stand to make a big impact on the industry going forward. Anna, what do you have for us this
Whoa,
week?
Whoa, I get to go first. Mm-hmm. So exciting. Okay, well, I selected a story about Boeing, who is reportedly in talks to buy Spirit AeroSystems. What?
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a great mashup.
I know. So Boeing is apparently in talks with Spirit AeroSystems, which builds fuselages for the MAX 737 jetliners, including the one that suffered a door panel blowout in January. The Wall Street Journal said Friday that Spirit hired bankers to consider strategic options and has held preliminary discussions about a sale back to Boeing, who is, in fact, its former owner. A deal could help Boeing respond to critics who have blamed the company's manufacturing problems in large part on outsourcing key work to Spirit and other suppliers. Mm-hmm. So obviously, we've talked about the history here. Boeing spun off Spirit in 2005. In recent years, quality problems have mounted. Financial problems have mounted. Spirit lost $600 million last year and has not turned a full year profit since 2019.
That's a challenging year.
Yeah, it had some challenging years in a row. reading this, I don't know, you know, maybe this is just, I have a skeptical eye for stuff like this, but to me, this was a long time coming. And, you know, we've discussed in the past how Boeing would probably ultimately need to come in and assist relative to Spirit's insolvency issues. Many experts have pondered if a buyback would eventually take place. Mm-hmm. I think the quality problems may have been what pushed Boeing over the edge to say the time is now.
Yeah.
They can't keep funneling money into Spirit AeroSystems, who does 70% of their work for Boeing, and not have a handle on the quality piece either. But do you guys believe that this would have taken place either way? Because I kind of do. I think now Boeing has timed it well so they can use this to show regulators that they are taking on the quality problem. And again, maybe that's just too skeptical of an eye to view this transaction. But it seems like a good way to spin something that would have already been a foregone conclusion, because to me, this was already writing on the wall.
Well, for me, a couple of things. One, how much of Spirit does Boeing already own? You know, with the like cash infusions.
The infusions, you know? Yeah.
The other is, what have we heard the last couple of weeks is that Boeing's house isn't in order either.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know that bringing it in house without like overarching change is a good thing.
You don't think they can say, hey, we're better at this than you, so we'll take over the manufacturing quality.
Yeah. Don't worry. We got a finger on it. It's fine. And I mean, not to like parrot everything that, our readership likes to post to pretty much every Boeing story, but like, hey, maybe it's time to get an engineer in charge. So that way there's someone that scrutinizes quality and manufacturing a little bit more than the bottom line. That was my only thing when I'm just like, my initial reaction to the story was like, I don't think two wrongs make a right, but who knows, Jeff, maybe they'll come together and the engineering prowess in both camps will bring them all.
Well, I tell you what,
no,
I'll start by trying to be glass half full.
Okay.
Okay. So let's look at it that way. I do think this gives an opportunity to potentially streamline a lot of situations, a lot of processes, a lot of production that sometimes when there's overlap and there's too many cooks in the kitchen, things just don't flow smoothly. And in that case, QA can be an issue. Okay. Because if everybody gets territorial or if everybody is looking at too definitive a route as opposed to the overall bigger picture, maybe there can be some issues there. So bringing that closer together, maybe there can be some, hate to use this word, synergies.
Oh, yeah.
That can be optimized in producing a better product.
If there's ever like an ideal candidate for requiring a couple of synergies,
yeah,
I think it could do some good here.
Yeah. Sorry to throw out those off way overused terms, but
that's how it didn't make me angry. So I mean, it's appropriate here. Normally I'm just like, duh.
So that's what you would shoot for.
Mm-hmm.
I do think this is a deflection move right here. I think this is basically what they're saying. Yeah, it was definitely on Spirit. We're going to step in. Big yep. Brother's going to take care of all this and we'll get it figured out. The part that I found also interesting, in addition, you guys have already covered a lot of the other quality issues, but 70% of the business is for Boeing.
Yeah.
The other 30 is for Airbus.
Oh.
So is there sort of a way of gaining a competitive advantage potentially here by saying, well, this is us now. This isn't a subsidiary.
Yeah.
This is Boeing. We're not going to make parts for our competitor.
Yeah.
Or we're not going to do things in support of Airbus. Does that provide them some sort of leverage? Does that slow Airbus down in some way, shape, or form? I would say maybe temporarily. I don't think that's a long-term dynamic. But if you're looking to make some short-term gains and gain some footing, we've seen a lot of things how Airbus has really drawn even with Boeing in a lot of respects over the last 5 years based on all these issues. Maybe this is another tactic by Boeing to strike back at basically their only competitor.
Do you think regulators would force them to spin out that 30%?
See, I don't know how all that would come together.
Like,
due to the fact, like you said, Boeing already had a vested interest. It was essentially a subsidiary already.
Yeah.
They spun it off, but I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how all that plays out. I would be surprised if this doesn't go through.
Right? Yeah, just like, hey, let it go through. Otherwise, they're insolvent. Jeff, what's your in case you missed it this week?
Well, you know, we haven't talked enough about like batteries and power for vehicles and stuff. So
nice.
Thought I'd pick another one here and picked a story talking about a consortium that's aiming to develop more sustainable sodium batteries. Now, I've talked about this a little bit in the past because when we look at lithium ion batteries, there's a lot of concerns about mining for all those rare earth elements. There are some issues in terms of converting them over to power, recycling the batteries, all of that kind of stuff. So it's not a perfect power source. We do have one that works in a similar fashion, and it's very easy to find and very easy to get to, and it's sodium.
Yeah.
Now, the problem with sodium batteries is they're just not dense enough. So they don't pack enough power. So all those range issues we were talking about before, sodium does not solve that.
Yeah, way
worse. It's an issue, but like I said, from a production perspective, it's very friendly. So the story is about a consortium of companies that have come together, and this is based in a German university, where they performed a project where they're going to spend 3 years, and they've gotten a little over $2 million in funding to basically put together a better sodium battery. Mm-hmm. Like I said, they've given them 3 years to do it, and they're going to look to solve a lot of those problems. Why I think this is important is, number one, we've talked about hydrogen, and we've talked about it in a lot of different applications and potential, and I think at least here, I think there's a consensus that it's probably not going to overthrow EVs as far as consumer transportation. With EVs, we know all the stuff. Like, we want to get better at all the stuff, but we know all the things that are sort of in the way, either good and bad. Sodium batteries are another one of those that I think is going to have to be investigated and sort of played out to see if this is a viable solution going forward. And I think these types of projects, more so than, in my opinion, knowing that this is the solution, this is the answer, we'll know either way.
Yeah.
After 3 years of playing around with this and the same type of development that's still going to continue on at the EV level with lithium ion batteries, we're going to know a lot more at the end of this project in terms of, should we continue down this path? Are we going to stick with lithium ion? What makes the most sense? But I find this really intriguing just because it would take a lot of those cost factors, a lot of the emission factors, a lot of the production concerns out of the equation, if we can make it work.
So hypothetically, in 5 years, Toyota's going to give you their free or their new sold car for free. Do you take a chance?
Well, here's the thing. Right now, if we just plugged in the current sodium ion batteries, we'd have no problem getting to work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we'd use the entire battery getting to work.
Yeah.
So if they can figure out a way to make the footprint smaller and bring in more power,
Yeah.
Absolutely. If I can at least get back home to replace the battery or put in a new one or whatever the case is, I would definitely play around with this one.
By the time this comes to fruition, I'm going to be that old guy that's trying to like recharge it by pouring a salt shaker on it. Just like, no, this is the gas.
I mean, you're not that far off.
Anna, your thoughts on the new advancements in salt battery technology?
Yeah, I love a great battery advancement story, of course. And, you know, the thing that I thought of, too, when I read this is they said that it's they think beneficial for shorter run type transportation applications. I mean, what about the applications for plug-in hybrids? I mean, you see a ton of those where they offer a lot of value to short commuters and their batteries are good for like 20 miles.
Yeah.
Of range, and that's enough for a lot of people to get to and from work or whatever. And you know, companies like Ford have talked about lately that they are going to invest more in building plug-in hybrids. They think that people want kind of to meet in the middle on the electric versus gas thing. And so I do think we'll see more development there. And to your point, if there's a way to incorporate battery technology that's more environmentally friendly, doesn't utilize all these materials that are very difficult and expensive to get, then great.
Before we move on to mine, in case you missed it, Jeff, do you want to say what this project has the potential to be?
Potential to be?
Could it potentially
be a thing that leads to the thing?
There it is! All right, my, in case you missed it this week. Airbus debuts next-gen air taxi ahead of first flight. Now, I chose this story because it came out, this happened today, and I thought it was particularly exciting. Airbus today unveiled the prototype of its fully electric City Airbus Next Gen, an electric vertical takeoff and landing vehicle, we know them as eVTOLs, designed to operate in major cities. The first flight is scheduled for later this year. The City Airbus has a wingspan of approximately 12 meters and will have about a 50-mile range with a cruising speed of about 75 miles per hour. The City Airbus Next Gen has a unique configuration. It has fixed wings, a V-shaped tail, and 8 electric-powered propellers. It just looks really cool. It looks really cool. Look it up. Airbus has been chasing the air taxi dream for some time now. Advanced air mobility between strategic locations in urban and suburban environments could complement existing transportation methods and alleviate congestion and other problems. This eVTOL could be used for everything from passenger transport to medical services. Now, I chose this not just because it happened today, but I do think that there is a realistic application for vehicles like this that can kind of, you know, take off like a helicopter and fly like a plane. Maybe at first, specifically for a faster, more agile flight for life, if you will. But also some applicability in terms of being a air taxi, which is what we're calling flying cars now because people don't care for that term. But maybe they're perhaps repulsed by it. But I thought it was a really cool development. And in the design and time that they kind of put into this thing, they also opened a new design center over in Germany that's going to be dedicated to the testing of the critical components, stuff like that, for the rest of the year leading up to the test. So I thought it was a really cool advancement. And they also have particular attention paid to safety and sound, which is another thing that we keep talking about in the aviation space. And man, if you're going to have an eVTOL kind of landing in urban areas, better be quiet, because I don't know if you guys have ever been near a helicopter. They are loud. Anna, I'll throw to you first, just because I was curious as to what you thought about the latest from Airbus, which they so eloquently named the City Airbus.
Yeah, I mean, medical transport for sure. Passenger transit. I don't really get behind this whole thesis that these planes are going to alleviate congestion. Like
1% of the congestion.
Like, how many are we going to need to alleviate congestion? Like, to take one car off the road,
yeah,
and put somebody in an air taxi. Okay, but like, you would need to do that thousands of times to alleviate.
That's the plan.
You're going to have thousands of these flying through the air.
Not at first.
At the same time.
Yeah.
And we're going to just air traffic control that.
Yeah. No, it'll air traffic control itself.
Yeah, yeah, I don't see that. I see like very specialized applications for these. I like the eVTOL concept for that,
mm-hmm.
being able to easily take off and land without a runway. That's a great and important development,
yeah,
for things like first response. Do I see this as the future of transportation? No, I do not.
I think it's part of the future.
I think it makes sense that Airbus wants to like replace cars with planes.
Yeah.
But I just
because they don't make cars.
Yeah, because they make planes. But I just don't see it as viable. I don't.
That's why I led with medical services, because I'm just like, she can't say no to this. She can't say no to better medical treatment. Another part of this story is that they recently partnered with LCI. They're a leading aviation company, and they're going to focus on developing partnerships and business models and strategy, commercialization, and financing. So, I mean, Airbus isn't ignorant to that fact that, you know, okay, we got to figure this out logistically. We mm-hmm. got to figure this out from a business perspective, and we got to figure out how we're going to pay for it. So, you know, Airbus is not just making the plane. They're trying to realize as to whether or not the infrastructure can get off the ground.
Attaboy. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you said you like the design.
Yeah.
I would be hesitant to get into that because that seems like a lot of wing to lift one person.
Oh, yeah, I guess.
That's a lot.
I love it. Like thinking of you walking up to it, just being like, I don't know, a lot of wing. Yeah. A lot of wing.
Seems like only it takes a little bit to go, something to go really wrong.
Well, unfortunately, yeah, you got a lot of wing, but you also have like those 8 electric rotors on top.
But it feels like it needs full power constantly for all 8 of those, yeah, or you are in a lot of trouble.
You're not going far.
Well, there is that.
Not going anywhere.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of, I don't understand. There's always so much resources put into these things. And like Anna said, the impact just seems like it would be so minimal.
Yeah.
I can see the medical application, search and rescue, all that kind of stuff. Just seems like a very limited application potential. I don't know.
I guess you're right. Like when we talk about the issues that we have with, you know, like Boeing and I mean, Airbus current aircraft designs. Sure. Maybe those could have used some updating.
Well, we're looking at getting away from fossil fuels for aviation vessels as well. So focus there. I don't know. I guess I've always been sort of about the whole idea of an air taxi, just because I'm not seeing it having a big impact. Something like this too. I mean, you'd have to pay so much attention to the weather in terms of whether or not you're going to use it, because it's not like you can circle for a long time.
Yeah.
You got a very limited range here. So I don't know. I understand this is generation three,
whatever. Yeah.
And there's more to come. So I guess we'll see where that takes us. I'll hold off judgment.
The Jetsons' future, it's going to be realized and it'll be in like major cities. I think that something like this would be realized in New York or actually probably somewhere overseas, like the UAE. I could see this taking off first.
So people who already have access to helipads?
Yeah. And
wonderful,
incredible amounts of capital.
David is sensitive to the needs of the 1%ers.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, come on. We got to figure out how it's going to work first. And I mean, this is not like a ready for everybody sort of technology. Just like, no, actually, it's only $40. It's cheaper than an Uber. I also liked how in June, Airbus partnered with semiconductor company ST Microelectronics to collaborate on R&D for the power electronics that they're going to use for future urban air vehicles. I also like that because when we're talking about improving the power electronics for these vehicles, that's stuff that we could see move into EVs and other types of transportation as well. So those types of partnerships are important for that. Well, let's move on to our final thoughts before we get out of here. Anna, what is your final thought this week?
So I took my my vehicle into the dealership this week to get an oil change, which ended up costing me $1,200 because it always does when you get an oil change at the dealership. That's why people go to Jiffy Lube. But anyway, I was looking forward to the like customer lounge, you know, the experience of like, because I had my laptop, I was just going to work while they did it. And then she showed me the area and it's coffee, tea and water now. And
yeah.
The coffee is like the worst coffee I've ever had in my life.
It's gotten sparse in those customer lounges.
What happened there? Like, I know that there was like an inventory thing for a while where they were like, if you want to buy a car, we have one. So you guys have to have a fist fight over it. Is that when they took out their granola bars?
No, it was. Oh, no. COVID. Use the COVID excuse for everything.
Oh, like, man.
Yeah. Because I was just like, you know what? Yeah, I'm going to overpay for this oil change, but I'm going to get it back in Cheez-Its.
Oh, yeah.
And no, Cheez-Its. And they used to make like. They had like the little pizza oven cookies and they would make those just constantly.
There's nothing there now.
No.
It was like very sad, like a tumbleweed rolled through there.
Yeah.
And then I threw my coffee away and sulked the whole time. No,
you need to have like a dozen bottles of water.
Yeah.
Just like line them up. Just like, I'm earning like, it back.
They're just like stuffed in my jacket.
And yeah.
Falling on the ground.
Well, everything went all right with the car though.
I spent $1,200, so I don't know. I mean, you tell me. Maybe for my car's future, but...
Okay, yeah, it's in a future investment.
Future investment.
All right. My final thought this week is just that with the warm weather, it seems like the spring and summer rush is, like, on. And it has started early, just in terms of, like, is your kid going to camp? Is your kid going to play the sport? Is your kid going to be in this sport? Can our kids be in this sport together? And it's just like, no, it's still winter. It's still winter. But all these registrations, like, open up right now. And I understand that it is a mad rush. But I just, you know, wanted a nice reminder that everyone can just take a minute and still be good to each other. And it's like, if you don't get your kid into the camp, it's okay. They're probably going to grow up to be a decent human being still.
No. No.
Yeah, you can't take a minute because then the camp is full.
Oh,
so, what, like,
okay, never mind. Don't be good to each other.
Is your advice
slash and burn it down?
Yeah.
Is your advice how to not get into camp?
Because
great
some,
advice.
You got to throw some elbows.
Yeah.
My advice, I guess, is to like get all the paperwork done early so that way when they do open up registration, you're already about 75. You know what?
Yeah.
Actually, you're right. I have a completely different take on this because he got into camp. That's the reason he was accepted into camp. You know what? Do all the paperwork early so you can submit it right on time and probably pay in full so that way they can't turn you down.
So were you just like, everyone be chill about this?
So that
a
way.
A thing that I did not do at all personally.
We were able to turn David very quickly.
No, I was chill. I was very chill about it. There's like, you know, okay, hey, we're going to try this out. If he gets in, he gets in. If he doesn't, he doesn't. I mean, luckily he got in, but it was chill. It wasn't maximum chill, but it was chill. And I mean, okay, fine. At just the base, just be good to each other. Is we gonna be all right at that one? Okay.
All right.
No,
fine.
No pushback on the be good?
No. Nope.
Okay.
Well,
Jeff.
You know, you had kind of a was it a negative experience, Anna, or just sort of a disappointing customer service experience?
It was fine. The customer service was fine. I just feel like the lounge has gotten to be sort of lame.
Yeah, it makes you kind of like. Judge the dealership too, right?
A little, yeah.
Because I would go I had an experience that was exactly the opposite. Not the car dealership. We talked about that. Mm. I also had a similar escalating. It was like a Target-like experience where you go in for toilet paper and you walk out with $300 worth of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
That's what happened to me at the dealership as well. But I'll
save
that for later.
Yeah. Yep.
But we also ordered some furniture and they delivered the wrong color.
Oh.
And so they're getting it off the truck and my wife catches it right away. She's out there talking to him. And whereas maybe it was a little disappointing what you experienced, like it was the exact opposite because within minutes, the salesperson at the furniture store was on the phone with us apologizing, saying, hey, these are your different options. We're going to waive the delivery fee. All of these other things like really went out of her way to still make you feel good. Because when you buy something like that, it's a new piece for you. You want to feel good about it. It's a little bit of an investment or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I'd never experienced that with a furniture delivery before. Typically, it's like, well, yeah, we screwed up, but it's going to be like a month or two before we have that back. And she had three different options for us and what we could do. And we're probably going to get it like this week.
It was
very impressive.
Yeah.
In terms of, and even just the fact that she took the time, it was a Sunday.
Yeah.
And she still followed up like immediately and called us and all that. It was, like I said, very impressive.
I thought it was going to be like an impressive story of sales tactics where it's just like, and now we just got a blue couch because she sold us on why this one's actually the better deal.
Yeah. No, the exact. So it was kind of cool because usually that goes the other way.
It definitely does. Like the last time that happened to me, the end of the call was just, you're never going to buy anything from me again, are you? I'm just like, nope, Dennis, I'm not. But hey, we'll get through this. So it's good to hear that. The other side of that happens.
Look at me with a positive story.
Yeah.
There we go. There we go. That's a good one to end it on. All right. Well, before we get out of here, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You can also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Jeff, David, or Anna at IN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You can also subscribe to our daily and weekly newsletters. Make sure you get them delivered to your inbox first. And subscribe on YouTube at IN Magazine, so you can join us when we go live every Thursday at 2 p.m. All right, for Jeff Brenke and Anna Wells, I'm David Manti. This is the Today in Manufacturing podcast, and we will see you next week.